Attention one and all, guys, gals, and non-binary pals. Please welcome to the stage Dr. Hannah Little!
Hello, Bristol! Welcome to North Shore! This is the first time we've done it in this venue, and I think it's a sellout. Woo! So can you give me a cheer if you've been to North Shore before? Oh, that's a reassuring number of you. Thank God. You know what you're in for. Give me a cheer if you haven't been before. Oh, actually, no, that was a bit louder. Okay. Never mind. So just to give you a bit of an idea of what to expect, tonight is a variety show. It's a variety show where all of the performers are people who work in science or technology. Or maths. We've got some mathematicians as well. Don't want to omit them. These are people who work in STEM fields in their day-to-day lives. So they're not professional comedians, but they are fucking funny. This isn't their day job. They're not used to it. So just to warm you up, I'm going to do a bit of cheering practice before we get started. Can you give me a cheer at this side? I am doing absolutely excellent at it. And this side? And give me a cheer if you're a nerd. And give me a cheer if a nerd has brought you along this evening. About half and half, isn't it? I'm really excited at the minute because it is September. September is the start of autumn. Autumn is my favourite month. I have started belligerently wearing a scarf. I'm really hot right now. The lights are on me, and I'm wearing a scarf, and I'm not going to take it off until at least February. And that's where we're at. I've got this theory, this hypothesis that autumn is actually the favourite month of all nerds. So just to test that, if you're a nerd in the audience and not autumn is your favourite month, give me a cheer. And for control, if you are a nerd and autumn is not your favourite favourite season, give me a cheer. jury's out a bit. And it feels from my perspective that the same people are cheering every single time. Just to fuck with me. So I'll explain my reason as to why I think that autumn is the favourite month of the favourite season of nerds. Sorry. First off, I think it is the season when it becomes acceptable, socially acceptable again, to lock yourself inside and read because of the weather. Summer, you know, people are asking you to go outside all the time. It's awful. I've left the house tonight. It's going well. Secondly, it's the season when everybody goes back to school. Who loves school? Oh, come on. Guys. All right, that's not a winner in the room, not to self. And thirdly, it's the season that includes the holiday Halloween, which is the holiday where it is suddenly socially acceptable to walk around dressed as a Dalek and people do not look at you oddly, which for me is just heaven. So, hello, as Will said, I'm Hannah. I'm a linguist. Thank you, whoever did that. A lot of people don't think linguistics is a science. One time I did a whole set about linguistics in York, and a lady came up to me afterwards and at the bar, and she said, "Oh, I think that was really brave what you just did." And I was like, what do you mean? And she was like, "You know, you've come to this event about science, and you just came and talked about the arts." And I just thought, oh, fuck off. So we're doing that again. Deal with it. So I work in linguistics. And one thing that I'm really, really interested in linguistics, a lot of my research is about, is how we talk to people with whom we have no shared language. So oftentimes that might be people that you meet on holiday who don't speak English, or evolutionarily speaking, it might have been our ancestors trying to kind of come up with a language in the first place. And how did they do that? And a lot of What that has to do with is shared knowledge, and I'll explain what I mean by shared knowledge. So shared knowledge is knowledge that, well, we share, right? It's not that complicated. But if I want to communicate with you, even if you speak English, I'm making all sorts of assumptions about what you know and the words that we share. So if you have never seen a cup before, I can't use the word cup with you because you won't know what a cup is, right? That makes sense. Now in my day job, what I do is I'm a lecturer in science communication, which I guess explains why I'm emceeing this. I suppose. And a lot of that is about shared knowledge too. So if you want to communicate about science to the general public or somebody who was not previously aware of your science, you need to make assumptions about what they know and what they don't know. And so you can't just usually go in full force talking about ions and quarks because they'll look at you like, what the hell are those things? Maybe they would in this room looking around. But you're a bad example, guys. Did you just call yourself nerds? Nice. So shared knowledge is important, and it's important when we're trying to communicate. But one instance in which it will be more important than any other instance is when aliens land, and we need to talk to the aliens, right? And in order to talk to the aliens, we need to make all sorts of assumptions about what the aliens might know or might not know, right? And has anybody seen the film Arrival? Ooh, I like that. There was a slight gasp. Ooh. I have an Arrival tattoo if anybody wants to see it in the interval. Has anybody not seen the film Arrival? Oh, okay. So a few of you. So for the benefits of the people who have not seen it, and also for the entertainment of those who have, I'm going to enact a small scene from the from the beginning of the film. So what happens is, aliens have landed. That's not really a spoiler, it's in the trailer. And Amy Adams plays a linguistics professor, right? And she's in her office doing her linguistics. Doing linguistics is not funny. It's how I make a living. And Forrest Whitaker lands in her back garden in a helicopter. And he walks in and he says, "We need somebody to do a translation." And Amy Adams is like, "Did you really just land in my back garden in a helicopter? Like, what the fuck?" And he says, "You did these Farsi translations for us." He's an army colonel, by the way. I didn't explain that. You did these Farsi translations for us. Sorry, I'll pretend to be Forrest Whitaker. I need you to translate this. And he gets a recorder out of his pocket. I've got props, don't worry. And he puts the recorder down and he presses play. And the recorder does this, it goes. That was pretty good. Thanks. And he's like, "Can you hear any words, any phrases? What can you tell me?" And Amy Adams is like, "Thank you, I'm glad you laughed." Amy Adams is like, I don't speak alien. I don't know the situation. I don't know what's around them when they made these sounds. I don't know how they pronounce sounds. I don't know what language they use. I don't even know if they use sound to communicate. That's an enormous assumption." And Forrest Whitaker's like, "What? You were like really good at Farsi. I don't get this." "You're laughing, but that's really what he says." And Amy Adams is like, "I already spoke Farsi, mate. What? I've got nothing to start with here. I've got nothing to go on." And then he went, "Oh, forget it then, I'll go and ask somebody else." And he goes to walk out, and then she's like, says something about Latin, I don't know, right? But the point is that if you don't have the context, if you don't have any information about the situation in which the aliens make these sounds or whatever it is they're producing, you've got no way to start encoding that, right? So, that film's fiction, but in reality, humans have in fact tried to communicate with aliens. Has anybody heard of the Golden Record? There's magic. So, this is the Golden Record. People often confuse it with the Pioneer Plaques. So the Pioneer Plaques are the plaques that went on Pioneers 10 and 11 that had naked people on them. You'll notice that the Golden Record does not have naked people on it. Oh, sorry, I should explain what it is first. I'll do that. So Pioneers 10 and 11 and Voyager, which had the Golden Record on it, were space probes that during the 1970s, humans sent up into space to the very edges of the solar system. And they've now passed the edge of the solar system. They've left the solar system. We've lost communication with them. We don't know where they are, right? They could be anywhere. But the idea is that these things have gone off into space. And at some point, thousands of millions of years from now, that's a long time, Earth will probably not exist then, but these guys will. Aliens will come across them and they'll find this stuff and be like, ooh, what does that mean? So, yes, on the Pioneer Plaques, they had naked people. The Golden Record came after the Pioneer Plaques. The reason that the Golden Record doesn't have naked people on it is because NASA got a load of complaints from people about us sending nudes into space. That's true. But imagine them. I just want to take a moment for us all to just sit and think about the mindset it takes to complain about us sending some pictures of nude humans into space and assuming that the aliens have the same cultural hang-ups that humans have about our naked bodies, which we didn't even have, thousands of years ago. We were all just walking around naked all the time and nobody gave a shit. People. But anyway, so this is the Golden Record. So one thing that is different from the Pioneer Plaques is that there's no naked people, right? Fine. But there's two things that are the same about this Golden Record and the Pioneer Plaques. One of them is this guy down here, which you can't really see, but this is a representation of hydrogen. So hydrogen is the most abundant element in the whole universe. And so if there are aliens out there, intelligent life forms, they probably have worked out hydrogen exists. You can't really see it, but it's around. And so if they find this, they're going to know. Oh, they know what hydrogen is. They're intelligent life forms. They're probably all right. Right? No, it's what it's for. Right? Shared knowledge. We've worked out the one thing that we know the aliens know. Well, probably they know more than one thing, but we've worked out at least one thing that the aliens know that we also know, and it's that hydrogen exists, right? So this is actually a super smart way to start communicating with the aliens. We've worked that out, right? Tick. Next, this is the other thing that is on both the Pioneer Plaque and the Golden Record there. That is a pulsar map. And that shows the aliens, from using pulsars from our sun, exactly where the sun is in our galaxy. So they can pick up these pulsars and use this pulsar map to find us. Has anybody, when they download a new app onto their phone, been asked, are you happy with us knowing your location? And do you ever pause and think, am I happy with that? Sometimes the answer is no. But our descendants, hundreds of millions of years from now, haven't been asked this. Some blokes in the 1970s, including Carl Sagan. I was told that a finger puppet wouldn't translate on stage. It's not big enough. This is Carl Sagan He designed this, and he decided on behalf of all of humanity to tell the aliens hundreds of millions of years from now where we are. And I'm not sure I'm okay with that, especially since we also sent them our nudes 3 years earlier. Okay, I think it's about time that I'm going to bring on the first act. Before I bring him on, we're going to do a bit more cheering practice. So this side, give me a big cheer. This side, give me a big cheer. Okay, so we've got our first act is, I've forgotten his name, it's fine. His name's Stephen Litherland. He's a stand-up and a biochemist, and he's going to talk to us about CRISPR and why some people have been very naughty with it. Let's give a big hand for Stephen!
Good evening, how are we doing? Oh, what do we think of linguistics? How's your English?
Terrible.
Well, someone's learned something. Right, so let me figure out how this works. So my name's Steve Litherland. I'm here to talk to you about Kellis CRISPR. And that is obviously me in the lab every day. After my, the famous jazz solo. Na, da, 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 la, la. Love a bit of George Clooney. But, so, CRISPR. What is CRISPR? So CRISPR is clustered regularly interspaced short palindromic repeats. So we've cleared that up. Everyone on the same page? Yeah. So it's DNA. Everyone loves a bit of DNA, don't they? So these are short little repeats of DNA that interact with proteins. A family of proteins called Cas proteins. And Cas proteins are CRISPR-associated proteins. Now you can see where all the effort of naming went, can't you? This was a morning meeting with the boss. This was after a pub lunch. Third pint would be all right, wouldn't it? Yeah. What were we doing? Oh, we're just naming shit. So we got CRISPR, our DNA, and Cas, our proteins. So where do they come from? They are bacterial antivirus. So bacteria get viruses, same as we do. And you've got this cheeky little virus here with his shooting DNA, RNA, depending on the virus. So we've got a whole load of Cas proteins to try and combat these viruses. So what we're going to be looking at today is a certain protein called Cas9. And there it is. I don't know if you can see it. So you've got the protein kind of blue bits here and the DNA in here. And these are the short palindromic repeats. So to really emphasize and get across to how this mechanism works, I'm going to need some volunteers from the audience. So can we get the house lights up, actually, so I can have a good look at all of you? Right. So can we have hands up for volunteers? So volunteers. God, we've got to have more than that. Here we are. You, sir, if you want to come up on stage with me. Of course. These are obviously in solution. So, and how about the pair of you, actually? So, right, what I'm going to do is, first of all, I need you to... Have you got a pen on you? Has anyone got a pen? Because I've forgotten. Nearly had it. No one saw, it's fine. So if you just want to sign that. Right, now, if you two want to organise yourselves... Yeah, it's fine. You don't need to read it. So, you two, if you just want to organize, so if you want to be the DNA and you want to be the protein, and you just organize yourselves like that, just like that. So just, or in a complex like that, is, that's right, you need to be joined up. You need to be joined up. And this here is for you.
Where does it go?
So on your face. And lovely. There's little hooks for your ears. That's fucking atrocious. What are you playing at? Come on, I'm glad you're not a structural biochemist, so I'll be honest there. So if you just want to hook your arms. And you stick your arms through. There we go, that'll do. See, stick your arms through so you're puppeting. Yeah. Yeah. Hey, there we go. If I've seen a DNA common protein complex, that's it. That's what. So, what's your name, sir?
I'm Flynn.
Flynn. So, Flynn, tell you what you remind me of is a piece of viral DNA. Very nice. It's been said. You know, it's a good compliment. So, you are a piece of viral DNA. Oh, it's super beard. It's nice. So, what happens is you, as the piece of DNA, will recognize him. So there will be something in the bacterial genome that says, as a piece of DNA, you recognize anything with arms. Guess what he's got? So you need to bond with him and what are your names?
I'm Joe. Hi.
Scarlet.
Joe and Scarlet. So we've got Flynn, Joe, Scarlet. So you need to tell Scarlet that he's got arms. How are you going to do that?
By just telling her?
You've got arms?
I've got arms.
Oh, no, he's got arms. Who's got arms? You've got arms.
I think I found
Flynn's
it.
Got arms.
Very good. Shake your hand on that. But, so, now what we do is you, as the protein, would dismember the viral DNA. Now, normally, we wouldn't be allowed to do this, but Flynn has very kindly signed this form. And,
What's it say? I, Flynn, hereby permission for my arms to be ripped from their sockets for comedic effect. Signed, Flynn.
There we go, we've all seen it. So if, Scully, if you just sort of pop his arms out of his sockets, just, no, come on. No, a little bit. All right, I see what we're working with. So Flynn has been effectively cut up into pieces. And one of the pieces that's been cut up is his beard. Do you want to take it off otherwise? I'm going to rip it off otherwise. It's going to hurt. Yeah. And then this makes its way in to the genome. Fucking science. That's what I like to see. Thanks, Flynn, if you'd like to take your seat again. So now, as a very clever biochemist, what I can do is I can find a gene construct like this, which I think you'll agree looks a bit like viral DNA. Now, if you want to hold that, if we take that. Now, what the bacteria does is it then produces a new bit of DNA with a beard. If you want to pop that on, you can use your arms. That's fucking great teamwork. That's DNA protein complex right there. Give him a round of applause. And what I do with my bit of DNA, Hold it up.
Well, hold that for me.
Is I can attach this to a DNA probe. Then what I put on my probe is my gene of interest. Oh. Yeah, you fucking love it! That's classic right there. And that way, it binds with the CRISPR-Cas9, is torn apart. Careful, this took me like 10 minutes to make. And then my gene of interest ends up in the genome. There's some successful genome editing. Can I have a round of applause for my volunteers? Thank you very much, guys. Right. Lovely stuff. So, that is a very simple overview of how gene editing works. So how does this relate to real life? So first thing it can be used for is with Anopheles, which is mosquitoes. So it's a common practice to make a population sterile, maybe not as you originally thought. Oh, God, that's a horrible resolution. It's a man holding a bent sausage, but it's a mosquito. So, but in fact, what you do is you find a gene that's really important to the female survival. And it's like, and what you do is you chuck a load of nonsense DNA in the middle. So you find it, and it's like having a car manual. And you just fill it full of erotic Harry Potter fan fiction. And all of a sudden, it's fairly useless. Unless you're that sort of mechanic. I don't know. So what about humans? Humans, here, you know, here's the big conversation. Humans have a lot of cells. Wait, Flynn, how many cells have you got with you tonight?
At least three.
He's not wrong. 32.7 trillion. Now, to put that in context, that's fucking tons. Yeah? So how do we even imagine doing this to people? So one of the things we can do is stem cells, these cells that generate loads of cells. So this has been done in sickle cell anemia. So you find your stem cells that produce loads of red blood cells, and you alter them. You alter them to produce a healthy hemoglobin, so thereby counteracting the effects of sickle cell and reducing the need for blood transfusions. So that's in adult cells, and it's not affecting the germline. So the germline are the cells you pass on to your offspring. And when we start editing those, we can end up with some interesting results. That's a new £50 note. So when do we consist of a single cell? Does anyone know what part of our lives do we consist of a single cell? As an embryo, it's a bit of in vitro fornication. So yeah, after IVF, when we've artificially inseminated an egg, and now we consist of one cell, we have one genome to edit. And now, what has happened, and this is not something that could happen, this has happened. So this chap here, can we... I've gone too far. There we go. This chap here, can we get it? Ooh. So I'm here to present a completely unbiased opinion. So this is a Chinese scientist, He Jiankui, which I'm definitely pronouncing wrong, has been a very naughty boy and already done this with human embryos. So there are children who he has edited the genome of alive today. And this is something absolutely terrifying. You know, this is not science fiction anymore. We've crossed into the realms of this shit happens now. So even the Chinese government has denounced his experiments. And the worrying thing is, we think it may have worked. You know, these are the rogue scientists who have decided, you know what? Fuck ethics. I'm going to do what I want. Yeah? I'm fucking ready to make babies. Don't want to get AIDS. Because that's what he's done. AIDS-resistant genes, which are not fully proven to be AIDS-resistant. There's not a consensus on what he's done. He's just done it. And ladies and gentlemen, this is the sort of scientist we don't want to be. Instead, we want to be doing gigs and having beers. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for listening. I've been Steve, this has been Kellogg's CRISPR. Thank you very much!
Amazing. Thank you, Steve! Thank you. Yeah, I'm not going to pause because that was really great. I'm going to introduce our next act, who is an engineer and not so secret diva. Please welcome to the stage, Kirsty Ware!
Oh, thanks.
Oh, I should have figured out how this worked before, shouldn't I? Oh, there we go. Cool. So, my name's Kirsty Wynn. I am a mechanical engineer, and I really like being a mechanical engineer because it's a very relatable profession. It can mean... Right? Some people don't agree. It can mean a car mechanic. It can mean plumber. It can mean data scientist. It can mean astronaut and anything in between. So, to clarify my position, I have a few key phrases that I like to use. Number one, favorite cars. Red ones. Favorite programming languages? Snake themed. More niche, but glad you got there. Nice. Third phrase, no mum, probably can't fix the toilet. Props can't do it. I might be able to, but I don't want to. So I learned engineering through lectures, textbooks, and trial and error. Who knew power tools could be so punchy? Yes. But I got inspired by TED Talks. Bloody love a TED Talk. I've thought long and hard about how I'd do a TED Talk if I wanted to do that, and it'd go like this. Emotive backstory. Beautifully illustrated graph. Power pose. Conclusion. I am incredibly charismatic. They're so bloody charismatic. And when I watch them, I feel like I'm learning, I feel inspired, and it turns out just very impressionable. Very impressionable. Or as I like to call it, cult ready. But today, from me, there'll be no inspiring. I'm not doing any inspiring. You might learn some things. You might laugh a bit, but inspired you will not be. And that's how you know you're talking to a real engineer. So today, I'm going to try and talk about finite element analysis. The last time I tried to talk about this, it was to a lady in a cafe. It did not go well. So this is round two. I feel like the first problem with finite element analysis is that it just sounds unnecessarily poncy. And there are other things that do this too. For example, Archimedes' principle, when I get in the bath, water cannot be where I am. Now tell me more about this fascinating principle. Tell me more. No, that's it, that's the whole thing. So, in a similar vein, finite element analysis, let's rebrand it. Finite, limited in size, not infinite, small. It's quite small today. Element, a piece, a segment, a portion, a bit of a thing. A chunk. Let's call it chunk for today. Analysis, investigation, inspection, study. Let's call it looking at things. So, looking at small chunks. The magic of rebranding by me. So, there are a couple of things we need to know about it, though. First, boundary conditions, i.e. what's happening at the edges. The edges. So if you're going to break things up into small chunks, you need to know what's happening at the edges of the small chunks. Normally, the same thing that's happening at the neighbor, because, like, yeah. But, sticky edge, mighty force. Different mighty force, different boundary condition. Mighty force. Oh... They don't like it. And the other thing we need to know is what's happening inside the chunks. Okay, we know what's happening at the edges, what's happening inside the chunks, because the same things can react differently to the same things, same boundary condition, different material properties. Different. That's why we always use steel. Just don't like viscoelastic things. Nightmare. So... Technical term, meshing, splitting the thing into chunks, right? So, if we want a rectangle, what could we use to mesh a rectangle? What shape chunks could we use? Small squares! Yes. I know, it's very exciting. If we were to mesh a dolphin, small dolphins? No, triangles, clearly triangles. Obviously triangles, come on guys. So the thing is that, like, if you were to use one triangle to mesh a dolphin, it would just look like a triangle, right? So the more triangles you use, the more accurate it is. That's one of the key things about it, okay? So smaller chunks, more accurate, but it means more calculations, because every calculation you have to do it again at each chunk. It takes bloody ages. So if you want to fancy do something like a car, fancy, many, many small chunks, a high-stress region, crumpling, take it to a garage. Take it to a garage. That requires lots of calculations, right? And that's all very well nowadays, but back in time, the first computers were just people doing calculations on bits of paper, normally women, and they did not get paid enough for that shit. Do you fancy doing this millions of times? If we break the system down into millions of chunks, you could do the same calculation millions of times. Wouldn't that be fun? No. So now, Titan. Fancy computers. Supercomputers. So fast. But how fast? Ooh. 27 petaflops. That's how fast. Ooh. I know. I kind of do. That means 27 quadrillion calculations per second. Faster than what you can do with some paper. A plus Titan. But Titan, to use Titan, is quite expensive. I work in Bristol. Very expensive. Don't get to use that. Tried asking. No one paying any attention. Okay. So, for less calculations, there are a few things we can do so that I can run it on my desktop at work, which is what I really want to do. So, one, increase the chunk size. If the chunks are bigger, there's less chunks, there's less calculations. Cool. But there's a limit to that because, like, as we said, if just one, like, you can't, like, a dolphin isn't a triangle. More triangles required. Fair. You can run it for less time. So in the same way that we're splitting up the object into chunks, we're also splitting up the time into chunks. So for example, if you want to like simulate something falling on the floor, what you could do is instead of simulating all the time that the thing is falling to the floor and then all the bounce back, you can start at the moment when it's just about to hit the floor and then just simulate everything after that with it traveling at some speed towards the floor. Saves you loads of time. Love it. And this is where the real engineering comes in. Ignore things that aren't relevant. Yes, good. Friction. Oh, that's sometimes not important. Air resistance. That's mostly not important. Static charge. That's almost never important. Bloody love it. So with this in mind, yes, this is basically engineering. But I just thought I'd like introduce you to some like engineering terms that are all about like ignoring things that aren't relevant. So first one, negligible. So if someone's like, oh yeah, I think the friction in this system is negligible, that means I don't want to think about that. Don't want to think about that. Okay. The next one, if the friction in the system is constant, right? That means the variation is negligible. Yeah, there we go. And if the friction in this system is complicated, that means I've no idea how that works. Yes, right, so end of the slides, but I thought I'd leave you on a small story about how I got into engineering. I know. Thanks. Okay, so when I was a kid, my mum believed in the power of positive thinking, and so did I, because she believed that I believed in it, and that's kind of how that works. And then I grew up, and I realized that the guy who like invented that, he invented this whole thing called like the New Thought Movement. It should have been a giveaway. New Thought, yeah, never mind. The New Thought Movement, he'd made loads of money off convincing people this was a thing, and he was a hypnotist. Fucking hypnotist. And I was like, and no one cared. And I was like, that's so unethical. And I feel like a fool. And from now on, it's only logic and reason. Only logic and reason. So now, I'm an engineer, a truth teller, and a deeply unethical hypnotist. It's working very well. And you may think that the people I work with, these engineers, fellow followers of logic and reason, might not fall so easily under the spell. But actually, you just show them videos of things fitting perfectly into other things. Just palm of your hand. It's amazing. All right. I think that's my time. Thank you very much for listening to me. I've been Kirsty Wynn.
Incredible.
Guys, I'm so hot. No. Never. I will sleep in it. I will wear it in the shower. Brilliant. So that was the marvellous Kirsty Wynn. And up next, yeah, she was marvellous. Up next, we've got Katie Cooper, who is a recovering scientist and also a massive pedant. Give it up for Katie!
Hi, this is Will from the future. Katie asked us to cut her bit out because she's still working on it and wants to get it down just right before she lets the rest of the world hear. So we're going to skip ahead now. Thanks.
Thank you so much. Enjoy the rest of your evening.
Wow. Yeah, give it up for Katie Cooper. And Kirsty Wynn. And Stephen Litherland. That was our first half. So now is admin time. Love admin time. You will have 15 minutes to go to the bar, get a drink, or go to the toilet, or go outside and do what you want. Just take this moment to say, if there are any nerds in the audience who see themselves at some point in the future stood here to do a set of their own, please come and see me or come and see Will, who lives in that little box up there. That's where he lives. You can find him. So just come and talk to us, because we're an inclusive bunch and we want acts and we want to include you, and that would be super cool. But other than that, enjoy your interval, and then back here at about 9 p.m. if I know what time it is. Yeah.
Please welcome back to the stage your host for the night, Dr. Hannah Little!
Thank you. Still too hot. But we've opened a door, so things are looking up. I'm going to continue talking a bit about the Golden Record. Thank you, Will. I don't know if you've noticed, I keep calling this a golden record. It is circular, and it is a record. So it's an actual record that you can play, and it has all sorts of sounds on it. But up until this point, I've only been talking about the pitches on it, right? But what are the sounds on it? They are the sounds of Earth. If you turn this over, that's what it says on it. I don't have a slide of that. you just have to imagine. And what's on there is all sorts of sounds of everyday life on Earth. So on there, there's a little bit of human speech. There's also lots of different examples of animal communication. So there's the sound of chimpanzees and elephants and hyenas and crickets and birds and frogs. And my question is, when the aliens find this... And by the way, this thing up here is like instructions on how to play the record, so we're not just imagining that the aliens have like old vinyl players lying around. Like, most of us don't even have that now, and it has not been 100 million years yet. Like, we've progressed to Spotify. Imagine what they'll have in 100 million years. So when the aliens put this on and they hear the sounds, how are they going to know which of the aliens are the intelligent life forms? So how are they going to know? Oh, they'll hear the hyenas and the crickets and the birds, and they'll be like, oh, yeah, that sounds like something that might be communication, sure. And then they hear the humans. How are they going to tell the difference? Like, there's no real reason why they should assume that human speech has any sort of superiority over the sounds of the animal kingdom. There's other sounds on here, including the sound of a tractor. So when the aliens do land, assuming again that they still have tractors in 100 million years, they might think that the alien that the tractors are the intelligent life forms. I just don't think that that's out of the realms of possibility. I don't know if they've thought hard enough about it. Other stuff that's on this record is like loads of different music from across history. It's basically music that Carl Sagan thought was like really good music. No, it's that's how they decided. They just like asked Carl what you want on the record that we're going to send to aliens, right? The first life forms, non-human life forms to ever hear human music. What music do you want to go on this record? And this story that I'm about to tell you is completely true. Carl said, I want the Beatles' Here Comes the Sun. Cracking tune, right? Not a bad choice. So he asked the Beatles record company, EMI at the time, can we put this song on this record that we're going to send into outer space? And it's going to go further than any human-built object has ever gone in the world before. Well, more outside of the world. It's going to go further than any human-built object has ever gone. It's going to go out of the solar system, and in about 1,000 million years, some aliens are going to find it, and this will be the first human sounds that they've ever heard. Can I take this song and put it on the record? And EMI said, no. For copyright reasons. That's 100% true. And if you ever wanted proof that copyright's a load of bullshit, which it is, I mean, I think that story says it all. Another thing that is on this record is an hour-long recording of the sounds made by the electrical impulses in the brain of Andrian. So Andrian was Carl Sagan's wife for many years. I do not have a puppet of Andrian. I'm sorry. I will be better prepared next time. But at the time when they made the golden record, they weren't yet married. They'd only just met, and they'd only just fallen in love. And when I first heard that they'd recorded an hour of her electrical of the sounds made by the electrical impulses in her brain, and apparently she'd turned to Carl and said, do you think if we recorded this, when the aliens find it, they will be able to translate the sound of these electrical impulses into my thoughts? They'll be able to translate it and know exactly what I was thinking when this was recorded, right? And when I first heard that, I thought, I'm going to write a bit about how ridiculous that is, yeah. Right? Because it is. Thank you. That one part. Yeah. That's just really dumb. But then I was listening to this podcast, and it was an interview with Andrian about that recording. And because it was right after her and Carl had fallen in love and they decided to get married, she said that she was thinking about all sorts of things during that recording. But one of the main things she was talking about was love and falling in love and the nature of love. And I cried at a podcast, right? I'm not ashamed of that. It was really beautiful and it really moved me. And then all of a sudden I realised that that recording isn't on that record for the aliens. There's no way that the aliens are going to get the record and they're going to be able to work out that these electrical impulses can be translated and mean whatever, right? There's no way. But there's such a human story behind that, and there's such a strong part of humanity and love and how we experience and our emotions that have fed into that hour-long recording, that's really why we did it. And it's a bit of us and it's a bit of humanity that's been set out into space. And I think that really illustrated why science or communicating science using comedy is not actually that great sometimes, because it makes us make fun of things that actually are quite human and quite earnest and beautiful. And that's not funny. But luckily, we have a whole improv group coming on in a minute. So don't panic. It's going to be okay. We've got an improv group. They all work in STEM, so that's science, technology, engineering, maths. Please welcome to the stage Rage Against the Machine Learning.
Woo!
Hi, this is Will from Side by Southwest, talking to you from the future. None of the improv group were near the microphones, so that didn't work out very well. We're going to skip ahead now. Thanks.
Thank you. Sorry, I got trapped in the corner by lots of chairs coming at me. Yeah, give it up for Rage Against the Machine Learning! Yeah, I mean, that bit about lecturers just reading Wikipedia, is that's just accurate. And I know from experience that you should never donate to Wikipedia, and I'll tell you why, because I did once, and now... I get emails constantly, which is fine, but the most recent one said, get this, from Jimmy Wales, arrived in my inbox, opened it, and it said, this is completely true, Hannah, I won't ask again. How cheeky is that? So, fine, that's me and Jimmy done. Because that's just rude. Right, we have our headliner now, our final act of the night. We have Safi Snell-Pym, who's going to talk to us. She's an artistic scientist. I like to think we all are, but Safi more so than all of us. And she's going to do a piece about a creepy moon.
Haven't heard me yet. Right. Creepy moon. The moon is made of cheese, yeah?
Yeah.
No. Instead, think rocks, think minerals, think potassium, rare earth elements, and phosphorus, which spells creep. Because potassium spelt with a K. Because science. Well, actually word roots and making sure that everybody is using the same symbols in chemistry. I feel I should probably tell you a chemistry joke now, but I'm afraid I just won't get a reaction. So it's poetry time. They say the moon is creepy, throwing shadows to the ground, while the face of rigor mortis grins in the funeral mounds. I'm a nice cheerful poet. The mythos of the moon is rich and complex. Stories that span back millennia. I think they've narrowed it down to 6 millennia. They are part of the journey that we have taken to understand our nearest celestial neighbour. But when you start really thinking about them, the stories and the nurse rhymes, they're actually really creepy. The man in the moon came down too soon and asked his way to Norwich. He went by the south and burnt his mouth by eating a cold plum porridge. Don't always make much sense either. So there's a man in the moon with his baleful eye, or sometimes it's a hare. They're those long-eared boxing rabbit things. I can hear the biologists groan in the audience, but most people know what I mean, the long-eared boxing rabbits. So it's supposed to be one of them in the moon. And, you know, maybe a woman brushing her hair. Some people used to say there's a woman brushing her hair. There are lovers trapped in the moon, not creepy at all, and an effigy of a ghost moon that comes down and entices travellers into the bogs and swamps and marshes to drown them. The dead moon, the dead, sit on the moon awaiting resurrection and judgment day. This was actually a genuine concern of people when the Apollo missions set off. Would landing on the moon break heaven and hell? NASA actually got letters about this. Smugglers especially around these sorts of parts, would even pretend they were trying to catch the moon in pools where the rum was hidden. You know, when the inspectors were about, obviously, especially in the southwest. Because Bristol has no history of smuggling, do you? No, none at all. No, no. All above board in Bristol. It's all about the rum. There are lots of stories in lots of cultures throughout our existence as a species. This is probably due to the fact that the lunar lantern was basically our only nightlight for most of that time. And the damn thing keeps changing shape. I mean, what is that about? That is just creepy, isn't it? It's named Selene by some. And it was the moon. The moon was astronomers' first love affair. You can see it with the naked eye. You can observe it, draw it, make glass lenses to see its features better. It remains the same outside of geological deep time, but everyone who stares at it sees something different. The impact craters and their radial rings were and are a source of joy for many moon gazers. Oh, look at the complex ring structure on that. These impact craters are named for eminent astronomers like Tycho, who died because he needed a piss and wouldn't leave to relieve himself, as that would have been rude. And he'd just been told off for being inconsiderate and rude. It's a true story. I'm expecting ours here. Recently, the planetary scientists have discovered that the moon's surface has ice in its deepest crevices. The media, however, used the word frigid. Frigid moon. I'm not sure what the various moon deities would have had to say about that, but I'm pretty sure it's going to be along the lines of, mind your own bloody business. The craters and the darker splurges of the basaltic lava were thought to be many different things, such as volcanoes and seas with life in and around them. The moon has been a source of many hoaxes. Many hoaxes. The biggest being published in The Sun in 1835, proclaiming a civilization of flying people, akin to those monkeys in The Wizard of Oz. Fly, my pretties, fly! Of course, such hoaxes of the past mean that as a science communicator, I have my back up against the record machine, if you know what I mean. When people announce that we can't have landed on the moon due to Van Halen's belt, it took me a while to realise that what they actually meant was the Van Allen radiation belt, something that does actually pose a real threat to the astronauts, but it's not a showstopper. Unless, of course, you get stuck in it, in which case diarrhea and vomiting to death in your tiny little space capsule is the most glamorous way to go. The Apollo astronauts skipped through the thinnest bit of the inner ring, being exposed to almost a fifth of what is considered safe for a nuclear reactor worker, so all good. I could spend an hour or more telling you about defecation in space and how the astronauts on the Apollo missions wouldn't order anything but the large condoms for their urinary catheters, regardless of what size they actually were. None of them needed large. But I'd be taking the piss. I will just say that Apollo 10 was actually the shittiest mission. No, seriously, there was feces flying everywhere, and they had to do a quick redesign of the ablutionary equipment, shall we say. Being the 50th anniversary of the moon landings this year, I have spent a lot of my time talking about the moon landings. So, how did we get there? On a huge damn rocket, of course. Rocketry has been around for over 1,000 years, probably invented by a Chinese warrior maiden, as a weapon. But it wasn't until the genocide science of the 20th century, the Second World War, etc., that rockets really took off. Able now to lay waste to whole cities. I told you I'm nice and joyful. After the war, they took the capitalist Americans and the communist Russians to space in a pseudo-war cheerfully called the Space Race. It was linked to the Cold War. The politics and ethics of this all gets a bit sticky. Just don't go there. Believe me, just don't go there. You'll just waste hours and hours of your life if you go there. It was a quick and brutal race, with deaths trailing the blaze of glory into the sky. Russia looked set to win, with Sputnik, the first satellite, and Yuri, the first human in space, which is why the US chose the moon. Neither side yet had the technology to get there. The Russians still nearly beat them. And where was Britain in all of this? Providing the US with the brain drain of engineers for the Apollo program. Of course, the main issue, or so I am told, was actually our explosives law. America and Russia both had amateur rocketry clubs, a base on which their governments could build. The UK rocketry club was more theoretical in nature, thanks to Guy Fawkes. Basically, they weren't allowed the explosives to try their rockets out. Plus, the London group almost got blown up by some of the first rocket bombs during the Blitz, including the sci-fi writer H.G. Wells. The chances of anything coming from Mars are 1,000,000 to 1, he said, but still they come. I'm hoping you're getting the cultural references here. Or it might have been Arthur C. Clarke, in which case I should have gone doom. Oh, are you joining in? Yay! Anyway, we got to the moon without crashing, just, and I mean just. And then we started collecting rocks. Yay! Rocks are my favourite thing, especially space rocks. Rocks from other worlds. The moon is our twin planet, far bigger than any mere satellite, and with the geochemistry to match. I.e., its rocks are like Earth's rocks, or at least the silicon-rich bits. It's like us, but without the iron core. But it's also different, too, because geology. Well, partition coefficients, actually, but mainly geology, or geologists. The moon's surface contains lunar breccia, spiky sand turned into rock by all those meteor impacts, smashing them up. It's also so, so shiny! Like, really shiny? The moon is too shiny just for, like, normal reflected sunlight, right? This is due to all the droplets of melt glass scattered as light-reflecting beads. Across the entire surface, it's a giant cat's eye, like the ones they use to mark the road boundaries and make road signs glimmer. The moon's silver is not a lot of moon snail slime trails, as a certain poet once suggested, just as well as that very idea is a little bit creepy. Not finished. There's more to come, I'm sorry. You've got me on the subjects of rocks and poems, you're doomed. Arguments about the moon's formation have gone on for eons, complete with wolverines in love and dragons mourning the sun. Scientifically, there is the wanderer. Wandering star, whom the saints preserved us. Planet means wandering star. As to early observers, that is exactly what they looked like. Dancing light points against a backdrop of fixed lights that didn't move. And the moon is a planet. Is the moon a wandering planet caught in our gravity? Or a child spun off as a molten blob in our early days? Or just another planet that coalesced with us, a twin, albeit smaller? in a protoplanetary disk. Say that one fast several times. We're looking at spouse, sprog, sibling. Which is it? The current leading theory reads like someone didn't want to upset anyone and so kind of mushed all three of these theories together. A Mars-sized impactor blammed into us, adding spin and possibly the tilt. It melted the surface and the middle layer of the Earth, mixing up with the molten mess, some say evaporating it, until a splodge flew off, or again was just this evaporated disk of it all whizzing around these two new little bits of planet, and they formed the Earth-Moon system, giving us tides and legends, and me endless questions to answer on lunacy and conspiracies. P.S. There is no apparent correlation with madness and the moon, but there may have been in the past, as light levels can affect sleep disorders. And you know that bit where it keeps changing size? Yeah, blooming thing. Well, that's kind of almost it now. Just one last thing. This is my moon on a stick. My husband asked me, what did I want? Moon on a blooming stick. I said, yes, I've got a moon on a stick. When the moon hits my eye like a big pizza pie, it means I'm hungry. So I'm off to get some pizza.
Give it up for Sarah Snell Pym! I've been sat backstage quite, just feeling a bit anxious, guilty is more the word, I think. It's guilt, yes. Because I told you not to donate it to Wikipedia. Please do, they do great work. And I couldn't have let you go home without telling you that. So that's the end of our show. Give it up for all of our amazing acts. Give it up for Stephen Liverland, Katie Cooper, Kirsty Wynn, Rage Against the Machine Learning, and Sarah Snell Pym. I've been Hannah Little, and thank you very much for coming. Have a great night.